More Americans say the U.S. is less safe now than at any point since 9/11. So what's the president's challenge in tonight's primetime address to the nation? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa State University political scientists Jim McCormick and Richard Monsbach join us for this Politics Wednesday. They'll weigh in with their expectations for tonight's speech and analyze the level of support the president has from Congress and from the American people for military action against ISIS. What are you hoping to hear in the president's speech tonight? How big is the threat from ISIS? Are you concerned we're being dragged into another long, costly war? Join our discussion after this news. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and most of this hour we'll be taking up talking about the challenge posed by ISIS, the challenge of terrorism. Jim McCormick is with us, professor of political science at Iowa State University, along with his colleague Richard Monsbach, also professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Richard and Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
More Americans say on this, the anniversary, the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attack, that the U.S. is less safe now than at any point since 9/11. It's according to a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll. New polls also showing a majority of Americans now support broadening U.S. military airstrikes against ISIS. This is the backdrop of public opinion that meets President Obama before his rare primetime speech tonight at 8 p.m. Incidentally, it's a speech we'll be carrying live here on our News and Studio One stream at Iowa Public Radio. The president will outline his plan to combat the terrorist group ISIS, a group that has taken over parts of Iraq and Syria, beheaded two American journalists, distributed images of killings in those gruesome videos, and launched a social media campaign to extend its reach. President Obama spoke Sunday on Meet the Press, where he defined what he needs from Congress regarding action against the Islamic State.
I'm confident that I've got the authorization that I need to protect the American people, and I'm always going to do what's necessary to protect the American people. But I do think it's important for Congress to understand what the plan is, to have buy-in, to debate it, and that's why we've been consulting with Congress throughout.
U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell, our minority leader in the Senate, spoke last week on Fox Business, outlining what he and other congressional leaders would like to hear from the president regarding the U.S. strategy for confronting ISIS.
We have the best Air Force. We have the best special operations. We have the best intelligence apparatus. And working with our European allies and people in the area like the Kurds, the president should come up with a strategy, present it to Congress, address the American people, and tell us how he believes we should stop them. This is not, in my view, a manageable situation. They want to kill us. We've had this experience before on 9/11. These guys are probably better able to carry out such a mission than they were, than Al-Qaeda was back in 9/11. So this is a serious threat to the United States, to our national security. And the president is the guy who needs to lay before Congress and the American people a strategy to deal with it.
Senator Mitch McConnell, minority leader in the Senate, we want to reach out to you, River to River listeners. What are you thinking? What are you hoping to hear from the president tonight in his primetime speech? Also on social media, we're asking on Twitter and on our Facebook page, if you could ask the president one question about the threat posed by the Islamic State, what would it be? Our telephone number, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Let me start with you, Jim McCormick. Size up the situation the president faces hours before this primetime address.
Well, I think what he has to do is to convey to us the magnitude of the threat that is posed by ISIS. You know, so far there's been the discussion about, you know, there might be a danger to the Europeans, but is it also a direct threat to the United States? And I think that's what he has to do. I think that has already been crystallized a little bit with these beheadings, or maybe a lot with these beheadings that have been sort of portrayed on television and video and so on. So I think that's the most important thing that he's got to convey. I think the second thing he has to convey is that the United States is going to take the lead, not alone, but take the lead as part of a group that will confront this, and that he has to indicate that he has support from European allies, but I also think most importantly that he's got support from Middle East states as well as part of this, if you will, coalition of the willing. I hope that he does not specify exactly what he's going to do. He will certainly say that he will use American military power in terms of addressing this and contributing to this. But I hope that he doesn't get too specific as he has done in the past. I think back to his Afghanistan speech in December of 2009, when on the one hand he said we're going to take these actions, and the other hand we're going to restrict our actions. I think he should be a little bit vague in terms of the specificity of the particular action. But I think he will get a positive response given the public opinion poll and really across parties from taking a vigorous stance on this and showing that he is on top of the situation.
Richard Monsbach, what are your expectations?
Well, I don't think you're going to get too sophisticated a response from Obama, because as of a few days ago, he had no strategy. My own sense is that, and I would disagree with one point Jim said about direct threat to the United States, it's going to be very difficult to argue a direct threat to the United States, but there is a threat to the United States. It's very significant. It's very indirect. And the first thing is that there are hundreds of Westerners, including many Americans, who have volunteered and are fighting in Iraq and in Syria for this organization, whether you call it ISIS or ISIL, as the president prefers, and who have passports to return both to Europe, their European homes and their American homes. And so these are what are called lone wolves. We saw one of them in the Belgian who attacked a Jewish synagogue and museum in Brussels, who was a returnee from Syria. The second problem, and in many respects much more complex, is militarily a very new operation for the United States. It's neither solely an air attack, the use of drones, for instance, Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia, nor is it many boots on the ground. But there are some boots on the ground already, despite what the president may say. There are several hundred of them. It also requires not simply, shall I say, rallying our friends in the Middle East, because, in fact, they're all over the lot. The Saudis and the Qataris have actually aided in the past jihadi groups, if not ISIS. They're Sunni. Their fundamental enemy is Iran, which probably, of all the countries involved in this issue, has the greatest at stake because, of course, it's next door, and it heads what is called the Shia Crescent in the region. And we're going to be put in a very odd situation. One, we are going to be working with, albeit we won't admit it, our Iranian foes. They will be providing some boots on the ground. They are already providing military advice to the Iraqi government. They are already providing training, and they're a member of the Al-Quds Iranian forces that are in Iraq at the present. And we will look to be, and this is going to be very difficult for the president to explain, we will look to be helping President Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who we have repeatedly, and who Obama has repeatedly said he wants out of office, the butcher of Damascus. And the butcher of Damascus, incidentally, has already started working with us, as it were, in bombing ISIS strongholds in Raqqa in the north and across the border in Iraq.
Just a year ago, Richard, we were pushing, there were forces pushing to bomb Assad's forces. Well, how will the president portray this now that we are allied, so to speak, against the same common enemy?
It's very subtle because it's worse than that. Not much more than that ago, the president declared an end to the war on terror and indeed asked for a repeal of his original authorization to use force after 9/11. Congress, thank goodness, did not give him his wish. How is he going to do it? I don't have the faintest notion. He is going to deny, clearly, that we are working with Syria. He's going to suggest that instead we're working against Assad in practice by finally providing, and the key word there is finally providing, military assistance to the moderates in Syria who are fighting Assad, the moderate Islamists and the secular opposition. In fact, it's a year too late, and Assad is very unlikely to be unseated. And indeed, the very people we should have been aiding a year plus ago are caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one side are the forces of Assad. On the other side are the forces of ISIS. To make matters even more complex, this organization is not your typical terrorist organization. It really is a state in the sense that it has remarkably diverse sources of finance. Indeed, it had been extorting businessmen in Mosul for the year or two before opening operations. It had been staging breakouts from jails in Iraq and Syria and staffing its people. And this leads to the second sort, what we could call indirect problem caused by ISIS. It's attracting huge numbers of young people and jihadists from all over the world in a way that, for instance, Osama bin Laden was never able to do with al-Qaeda. And ISIS has replaced al-Qaeda. And in fact, the ISIS leader, al-Baghdadi, is quite conscious of the fact that he is seeking to replace al-Qaeda and its new leadership under Zawahiri as the, shall we say, the jihadi institution most to be feared by the West and by others.
Richard Mansbach is with us, and his colleague Jim McCormick, both professors of political science at Iowa State University, in our Ames studio, talking about the president's speech tonight, the war on ISIS or ISIL, whichever you prefer. I want to reach out and ask you, do you support more intense bombing? We'll find out more specifics, perhaps not too many specifics, but more than we have at this point tonight when the president speaks live at 8 o'clock. Do you support the U.S. Deployment of ground troops? It's not thought that that will be suggested tonight. Are you concerned we're being dragged into another long, costly war? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Jim, we have to quote President Obama from a few months ago, I believe, saying that he would not allow the United States to be dragged into fighting another war in Iraq. How do you set up the campaign against ISIS without the risk of being dragged into a broader war?
Well, I think this is one of the statements that the president will have to just swallow. This is really something that he can't really avoid in terms of taking on ISIL, that he really is going to have the United States involved for a long time. And that, I think, will be one of the other messages this evening, that American people generally are impatient, want quick solutions. And I think what he'll have to guard against and what he'll have to make certain of noting is that that this is going to be of some duration here. But I think what he's going to do is to say, and as was pointed out by my colleague, is that to get some of the other participants involved in terms of taking on this fight, even as the United States has special operations and used some of its air power and so on. Just a couple comments, I think, on what Dick was saying here. I think the decision clearly has been made by the Obama administration that the greater danger is ISIL rather than Syria. And so, yes, there is this kind of tenuous balance of whether if we knock out ISIL or destroy and degrade ISIL, as the president has declared, that this props up the Syrian government. It is a difficult balance, but I think getting these forces in the region to supply both the military capabilities and the backing of this will be a way to try to balance off both of these goals. But it clearly is a very tricky proposition here.
Jim, I think that's easier said than done.
Sure.
An Iraqi army of 400,000 was put to flight just a month or so ago by some 10 to 15,000 dedicated jihadis. That was an organization of 400,000 trained by the United States, provided by the United States. And the reason, of course, was that Sunnis were not about to back the Iraqi government. That exclusivist sectarian regime under Nouri al-Maliki had alienated most of the country's Sunni minority, and indeed its Kurdish minority in the north. And those whom we depend upon, including King Abdullah, whom you mentioned coming from Jordan, are themselves Sunnis. And so one of the problems is, how do you persuade the Sunnis in the Middle East, who are those who must do the fighting, must reject this violent, thuggish group of extremists? How do you persuade them to do that without, in fact, they're suspecting that you're constituting an ally of the Iranian and the Shias in Syria? This is a real problem.
Richard, we had the news on Monday that Iraq swore in a new government under the huge international and domestic pressure to do so, including, if I'm not mistaken, a Sunni, also others in the government, a more diverse government that reflects Iraq. Doesn't this take a small step to address what you're just talking about?
A tiny step. First of all, the Sunni you're referring to is required under the Iraqi constitution to act in the government. Secondly, even as we sit here, while Mr. Kerry is voicing his optimism, Abadi, that's Maliki's successor, has not yet filled the most important positions in that government, which are the defense position and the positions dealing with security. Thirdly, even if he does, it's going to be extremely difficult to persuade the Sunnis that they should work with the Iranians and the Shia opposition. This has been probably the single most divisive cleavage in the area. This is all made more complicated when you realize that the president is speaking at a time when Washington is facing not one, but perhaps as many as four international crises, one in Ukraine, one in China having to do with Chinese pressure on the United States, and of course, the millennial-old problem of the Palestinian-Israeli issue.
Mm-hmm. A Facebook post from Dave. I want to get some of the input we're having from our listeners on our Facebook page. Also, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email, or you can tweet us on IPR Talk. Dave writing on our Facebook page, they call themselves a state, but like most of our enemies in the Muslim world, they are really based on an ideology. Our military is unsurpassed in taking out a geographical state. But how do you and the military advisors on such missions think you can strike at them without further inflaming the passions of such extremists, thereby adding to their numbers with new volunteers? It's damn hard to aim a smart weapon at an idea without collateral damage. That from Dave and our folks. But that really goes back to what you were saying, Richard, and also, Jim, you mentioned too. Officials and outside experts say an essential part of fighting ISIL and al-Qaeda, these similar groups, cutting their propaganda on social media and elsewhere. Jim, your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there is an effort within the U.S. government to do so. You know, a campaign trying to get the sort of the narrative right, but it is very hard to make that a reality. I mean, this just is one more of the complications that my colleague was talking about. You know, in terms of trying to take on a group like ISIL here, I'm not sure that you can do that in the short term. I think the immediate short term is to stop the kind of killing that ISIS has, and I think that's probably why the administration, and I guess I agree with this, should go for trying to dampen down these attacks that have occurred here. But maybe
let me just say, first of all, your caller put his finger on the problem when he referred to jihadi propaganda. Indeed, that's the reason why this organization literally broadcast the murder, the beheading of two journalists. It may shock Americans, but this is in fact extremely attractive to the extremists who are following this propaganda. The second point is not quite on target. That is to say, ISIS, unlike any other previous organization of its kind, does control a territory. There's no question. It's declared a caliphate, which, by the way, is also extremely attractive to extreme jihadists because it's the first time that has been done. Even Osama bin Laden never did that.
Tell us a little bit more about that word. The word caliphate, I want to make sure we understand that before you go on.
All right. The caliphate refers to the ancient medieval Islamic empire of the 6th and 7th centuries up until the 13th century that at its height governed the entire Middle East, actually governed across all of North Africa and had gotten as far as Spain before it was finally repelled. And it represented the entire community, or what Muslims call the Ummah, the community of Islam. The caliph refers to the successors to Muhammad, the prophet. And in calling himself a caliph, what al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, is saying, I am the continuation of a line that stretches from the prophet himself and his wise successors, as they were called, the caliphs, to the present time. And that's very attractive. But let me just say something about the territory occupied. This poses some serious military issues. First of all, one of the reasons the president has probably been persuaded to extend the bombing into Syria is the fact that this territory, or the caliphate, which Baghdadi has declared, is both within Iraq and in Syria. In fact, there was a symbolic leveling of a berm, a sand dune, which divided those two sovereign states from one another. So that, in fact, these folks can go back and forth across the border. And as long as they have asylum in Syria, obviously there are real limits to what any military campaign in Iraq can achieve. The second problem, which I think is even more difficult, is that air power may be effective against these people when in the open, when they are advancing as they did recently against several Iraqi dams. But they control the city of 1.5 million people, the second largest city or third largest city in Iraq.
Yeah.
Drones, air power are just of no value whatever in urban warfare of the kind that will have to be waged. This is going to have to be done by the Iraqis themselves and presumably the Syrians, whom we are, of course, not allied with, right?
Do we expect, very quickly, we have to a minute before we have to take a break, but is it true that to this point we have not bombed on Syrian territory yet against ISIS?
That's my understanding.
That's my understanding.
Right.
Yeah.
Do we expect the president to announce a departure from that?
Yes, I do.
I do, too. I mean, we've already been, flying over, obviously identifying targets that we could could attack within Syria. And plus ISIL is, as Dick was pointing out, in terms of the northeast part of Syria. And so that would be part of the attacks syndrome.
And I would just add one thing. That's the controversial side of his proposal.
Yeah. The real issue, though, goes back to what the caller talked about. How do you get the narrative to deter the attractiveness of this ideology?
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment to answer that and other questions, or give it a crack anyway. Jim McCormick is with us. Richard Mansbach, professor of political science at Iowa State University, on the eve of the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attack. We are faced with terrorism once again and the challenge posed by ISIS. The president to speak tonight at 8 p.m. We'll be bringing you that live here on Iowa Public Radio. Join our conversation. If you could ask the president one question about the threat posed by the Islamic State, what would it be? 1-866-780-9100. Back in a few minutes. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On the eve of the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks by al-Qaeda, we're talking again about terrorism, but contemporary terrorism, present-day terrorism, the challenge posed by ISIS, the Islamic State in Syria and in Iraq and Syria. Jim McCormick is with us, Richard Mansbach, both professors of political science at Iowa State University, two gentlemen with great minds who have studied the geopolitics of the world for decades, lending us their insights this hour. We'd like to have you join us with your questions, your comments. 1-866-780-9100. Do you support more intense bombing, what we're expecting from the president tonight? Perhaps the deployment of U.S. ground troops. That's not something we're expecting. Or are you concerned we're being dragged into another long, costly war? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, and you could also tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk, gentlemen, a little bit about congressional approval here. Yesterday, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell called on President Obama to back a vote in Congress on his military strategy before the November elections. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is backing President Obama's view that he can confront this Islamic State without congressional authorization. Jim, does the president need congressional approval?
I think he does. I know I'm going to disagree with my colleague on this because we mentioned it before the program here. The president, I think, is relying upon the resolution that was passed back after September 11, 2001, and also on the Iraq resolution, which gave the president really, at that time President Bush, really broad leeway in terms of conducting operations. The Iraq resolution is sort of open-ended in terms of saying that, as long as there's a threat from Iraq, the president could act as he determines. The president also, of course, is relying upon Article 2, the Commander-in-Chief Clause, and making certain that the laws are faithfully executed, which is in Article 2 as well, in terms of protecting American lives, particularly as he links this threat to the United States. But my view is that the Congress has, under the Constitution, the responsibility for declaring war here. And I think that the Congress really should step up to a vote. I can understand why members of Congress, particularly before an election, may not want to do that, because they don't know how this is going to go. And this is going to be a vote that's going to come and be an albatross around their necks later on if they vote presidential approval. I think the other reason is that some in Congress simply know the kind of delay that might occur with trying to get a resolution, to fine-tune a resolution to put some strictures on the president, and they don't want to hamper what has already been a very long, drawn-out kind of strategy session on the part of the administration here. So I think there's some good sort of political reasons for why Congress, but I think constitutionally I would be much more comfortable if the Congress were to act.
Dick Monsbach, you see it differently?
I see it very differently.
Okay, let's hear it.
Regardless of the legal situation, which of course has been violated repeatedly by presidents, if Jim is right, over and over and over again since the War Powers Resolution. I think the delay would be horrendous. I actually would agree with Jim. I think that about the question of the elections, because appropriations would probably not be forthcoming until afterwards, and this has to be done now. Can't be waiting. If there's a problem with going to Congress, in my judgment, the problem was created by the president himself, and that was a year ago over Syria. The president, as you know, imposed his judgment on his closest advisors when he surprised them and said, after Assad's use of toxic chemicals in a Damascus suburb, in saying, well, what do you think? I'm going to go to Congress. They were appalled. But I think the president recognized then that he couldn't get approval from Congress. And whether he recognized it or not, he would not have gotten approval from Congress, in my judgment, at that time. But be that as it may, if there is a precedent, the president set it himself. And so it will be his problem to explain why he felt he had to go to Congress over the Syrian imbroglio, but he did not. He does not have to go in the case of Iraq. The fact is he would not have had to go in the case of Syria, and I don't think that he would have to go in the case of Iraq now.
But I think the president would point simply to the Iraq resolution that gives him, as I said earlier, gives him broad leeway, as well as the Authorization to Use Military Force Act passed by the Congress. And I think probably too broadly. I mean, it was passed without opposition in the Senate, was passed by 420-1 in the House. So the president will lean very heavily on that, as well as on Article 2. And I think, frankly, there is a sentiment in the Congress that they don't want to, despite, you know, their constitutional prerogatives, to impinge upon the foreign policy of the United States.
There's another difference. In the case of Syria, public opinion was strongly against intervention.
Sure. Right.
In the case of Iraq, apparently, recent polls suggest public opinion will back the president.
Yeah, remarkably large support. I mean, across party lines.
Right, and isn't it the beheadings that has changed that, made that massive swing in public opinion, the beheadings of Americans?
I think that was a tipping point for sure. I mean, as you may remember, Ben, a few weeks ago I made mention of that. I think that really was a tipping point in terms of getting the administration attention on this matter, to getting the president to act. And I think that horrendous display of disgusting action is really what rallied the American public.
Joyner?
I think there's a second reason that's connected to that. Again, the Syrian issue was and remains opaque. Who were our friends and who were our foes? And indeed, one reason for having told the president, and I keep coming back to this, what I consider gross error of failing to carry out his own promise to intervene in Syria. One of the problems was that the fear that if Assad was overthrown, he would be replaced precisely by the kind of people that we see in Iraq. Iraq, by contrast, at least appears to the American public to have bad guys and good guys, which is not true, I might add, but bad guys and good guys, white hats and black hats, just like a good Western.
Not true in what way, Richard?
Well, as I was trying to suggest before, some of our so-called friends are actually our adversaries in other contexts. They include Iran. The president's not going to mention that, I'm pretty sure. They include, shall we say, congruent interests with the Assad regime. They include Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, has beheaded more people this year than ISIS has, I must tell you, in fact. And they include, interestingly enough, a whole array of Shia figures in Lebanon. We'll probably even see Hezbollah get involved, in my judgment, in helping the Iranians in Iraq, which is just across, of course, the border.
Dick Mansbach is with us. Jim McCormick is with us. We've got a few more minutes left in the hour as we discuss the challenges posed by confronting ISIS, the Islamic State. In a few hours, the president will give a primetime address to lay out more detailed plans about how the strategy he plans to pursue in defeating ISIS. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook. Or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to Guthrie Center. Bill is joining us from Guthrie Center. Thanks for joining us, Bill. What's on your mind?
Oh, you know, I voted for the man two times.
President Obama.
Yes. But Obama, the president, is a sissy. He's turned his back on every moderate group that's tried to stand up. He won't listen to any good reason. He's let Ukraine go down the tubes. He lets the Middle East go down the tubes. He can't realize the Chinese military is out of control. He thinks he's got the World Peace Prize and that's it. Everything else is something for him to hide from.
Bill,
all I can say is, now maybe this is something out of the cartoons in the 1960s when it used to be that the king is a fink, but in this case, the president is a sissy.
Bill, in Guthrie Center, let's put some polling behind Bill's words to a certain extent. The latest NBC News, Wall Street Journal poll shows in the past few months of foreign policy crises, especially regarding ISIS and Ukraine, it's taken a toll on President Obama and his party. Just 32% approve of his handling of foreign policy. That's an all-time low in the survey. The GOP has now an 18-point advantage, according to this poll, on which party deals best on foreign policy. That's an 11-point jump from just a year ago. And the Republicans hold a whopping 38-point lead on which party best ensures strong national defense, their largest lead on this question in more than 10 years. This is the president who got bin Laden. Jim McCormick, what has happened?
Well, the president always came to office with this idea that he was going to sort of bend the arc of justice, as he was wont to say. and that he was going to take, try to not be Bush, I guess is the simple way to say it, that he was going to be much more cautious in terms of what the United States would do, would not get the United States involved in global wars, two wars. He would get the United States out of two wars. I think he had a much more benign view of the international system than it has turned out to be the case. I think that this is a trend with presidents. Sort of teach this over time that many times presidents come in very idealistic about how they can kind of transform the international system, and they're confronted by the reality of the world out there. And I think it's taken probably President Obama a little bit longer to move to what I would say is sort of the realist kind of camp in terms of the international system. So I think it's been a learning curve. It's been a slow learning curve for the president. And maybe we're at this juncture where he's decided that he has to act more forcefully. After all, the pursuit of Osama bin Laden was something that had been on track since 2007. I do give the president kudos for that action and pursuing that. But most other ways, he tried to pursue a much more benign kind of approach to the international system.
This morning, former Vice President Dick Cheney delivered a speech at the conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute. He was invited there to reflect on the current state of American foreign policy ahead of the 13th anniversary of 9/11 tomorrow. Cheney criticized President Obama, nothing new there, for being disengaged and called for the president to deliver a forceful, bold, and immediate strategy to defeat ISIS in his speech to the American public this evening. Cheney also called for more military and defense spending in the coming months.
Even the wisest, boldest calls in the Situation Room will not come to much without the assets to follow through, whether by land, sea, air, space, or cyberspace. And when the next Congress convenes in January, I can think of no more urgent business than this. Leaders in both parties working together must ensure that the highest priority in our federal budget is the defense and security of the United States of America.
Richard Mansbach, are we on the eve of ramping up our military once again?
Well, I am, but I must say I think it's disingenuous to put on something by Dick Cheney or even listen to Dick Cheney, whom, to paraphrase Winston Churchill on Russia, is a disaster wrapped in a catastrophe. Who absolutely began this problem in Iraq. But let me just say to Bill, I too voted for Obama twice. I'm not sure I think that I would agree with Jim that he came to office as an idealist. I think he came with an almost too complex view of the world around him. That is in the sense that Iraq and Afghanistan taught lessons, but not necessarily the lessons he thought. And then he made a terrible mistake. He withdrew everybody from Iraq almost immediately on coming to office. It was no residual force. And I think, hypothetically, had Americans remained, at least some Americans remained, with boots on the ground in Iraq, this might never have occurred. The ISIS phenomenon might never have occurred.
Mm-hmm. On our Facebook,
But I want to say one other thing. The president does exude indecision, absolute indecision, and that is not a way in which you gain public confidence.
Especially the American public confidence, because they like decisive leaders who act quickly and produce results.
This is indeed a day that will live in infamy, for instance.
Let's put you on the spot a little bit to the extent that you'll allow it, gentlemen. 1 year ago, we mentioned we had hardly heard of ISIS. Perhaps you in political science had heard of ISIS, but mm-hmm. we were debating whether to bomb Syria because of their chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. Where might we be a year from now? What do you see the possible paths for us as we finish up this hour? Richard.
Well, I think we will be fighting ISIS a year from now. But then don't forget our campaigns, the so-called war on terror campaigns against other terrorist groups, Shabab in Somalia, the group in Yemen. We've been fighting ISIS for a long time, although most people don't know it. ISIS was originally the Sunni group in Iraq called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And Americans had their bloodiest battles during the last years of the war with this organization in Anbar province. So we've been fighting them a long time under a different rubric. I think a year from now, we will still be fighting them. I think the president was premature in declaring an end to the war on terror. But then the president, in my judgment, has made a number of rhetorical errors that have come back to haunt him. And this is one that's going to come back and haunt him. Will we have defeated ISIS? Well, you don't defeat a diffuse terrorist group which takes refuge in has sanctuaries across the border or is in cities. You don't defeat them that easily. I don't think we will defeat them that easily because I think my own guess is, and you're asking me for a guesstimate, is that the Iraqi army will be unable to do so. And it's the Iraqi army that's actually going to have the boots on the ground.
A year from now, Jim McCormick, what do you see?
I'll pick up on that very last comment because I think what's really critical here is what happens to the Iraqi government. Does this new government really stand up, incorporate some Sunnis? Is there really the kind of a Sunni reawakening that occurred back in 2007 at the time of the surge? I think that's critical. The other thing that I would think is my suspicion is that they're going to confine the fighting in Syria to try to root out the sort of the in Raqqa. I think it's the city of Raqqa where the ISIS is headquartered. I suspect there will be sort of a demarcation between allowing the Assad government to take control, but try to seize the area that ISIS has taken in northeast Syria. That's what I see in a year from now.
Jim, it's a third of the country now.
I know. Right.
I'd like to finish up by broadening this, talking out a little bit broader than the individual conflict we're talking about right now, focused on ISIS. Richard, you mentioned this earlier on in the hour, this global turmoil we're experiencing. Look at it as a whole, the terrorism, the threat of ISIS, the resurgence of Russia, the rise of China, the tensions expressed we've seen in the Pacific with China, the ongoing Middle East conflict. What is going on? Does all this conflict at this time have anything in common? Is it a lack of U.S. leadership, perhaps?
Well, that's certainly going to be argued. In other words, this is the moment of decline, not so much a lack of leadership, but a moment of decline. And this is perhaps most evident in the case of China and to a lesser extent in the revival of Russian military power under Vladimir Putin. There is some bad luck involved, though. I think that some of this is coincidental, and I think that I can think of no other administration, in my memory at least, that has had to confront so many problems so serious as the Obama administration has to confront today. And so that anything you do in the Middle East or in Asia, for example, will affect all the others. For example, the president promised we would pivot towards Asia. That pivot has been virtually forgotten because of these other crises. Let's put it this way. Have you looked at the president lately? His hair is much whiter than it used to be.
As is every president who spent that many years in the White House. Are we that correct there? But Jim, your view on the common thread, perhaps, in all the turmoil that we're seeing around the U.S., around the world.
Well, I think there has been this problem of decisiveness on the part of the president and on the part of the United States here. I would agree that part of it has been bad luck. What the president really needs and what the U.S. really needs is sort of a foreign policy victory that they could point to really resurrect some sense of American leadership. Now you're going to ask me next, where is that going to come from? And I'll leave that to Dick to tell us where that's going to come from.
Well, unfortunately, we have no reason to go back into Grenada, as Reagan did. And to my knowledge, the Mayaguez is no longer off to Cambodia. There's no easy one. There's no easy one. Mm-hmm. Jim and I argued at great length. Sorry, we didn't get into it in this program about policy towards Ukraine. Jim wants a forward-looking policy, which is an understatement. In my case, I was the dove and he was the hawk.
Well, we'll have to have the two of you back to hear some details of that disagreement there. Very quickly, before we go, we've got less than a minute. I wanted to see if you think there are sort of any ideas here that potentially could surprise us from the president. Are there any perhaps improbable things that could come out tonight?
I don't think so. I think the president really has to give a confident kind of leadership speech that demonstrates to the American public that he is in control.
Richard?
Amen.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much for your expertise this hour. Richard Monsbach, professor of political science at Iowa State University, and the professor of political science, Jim McCormick, also of Iowa State University. We appreciate your expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Once again, that speech by the president, primetime address, beginning at 8 o'clock Central Time, will be carried on Iowa Public Radio's News and Studio One streams. We'll hope you'll tune in for that. And tomorrow on this program, well, we use it to wash dishes, make our meals, clean our bodies, quench our thirst. Do you know where your water comes from? The journey it takes to your tap? Tomorrow on this program, we'll explore our aging water infrastructure, much of which dates back to the 19th century, and why we need a new approach to urban water systems. Water worries is what we'll talk about tomorrow on this program. I hope you'll join us. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. We had help from Garrett Van Leeuwen in Ames today. And Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.